The road to see which team will be the first to reach 16 wins is officially underway. The 16 teams seek the vibe for the chance to garner the Larry O'Brien Trophy, where only one team will get the precious opportunity to hoist the gold ball at season's end atop of the championship podium this upcoming June. What's going on, everyone, and welcome to the new 24 Kobe Bryant, Rick Barry, and Moses Malone episode. As we officially have reached 24 episodes, for those keeping track of things, we thank you, as always, for taking time out of your schedule to listen to us. Share what we have to say on the latest taking place throughout the 2025 NBA playoffs. I'm your host, Gabriel Wilkins, and as always, I'm joined beside my partner and co-host, Torrence Stagger, to discuss it all. What's going on, bro?
Hey, man, doing great. Episode 24, the Kobe Bryant Black Mamba episode, basketball's Jesus. No religious disrespect. If you understand, then you get it. You know, we all know who the basketball god is. We know who the king. And there lies a guy in the middle. It's a special number to us at the No 24. So we're going to have a special episode.
100%. On the previous episode of the New 24, me and Torrence took a bit of time to discuss the games you saw take place last week as part of the NBA play-in tournament, while also highlighting the things fans should be on the lookout for in the 3-versus-6 and 4-versus-5 matchups out in the East and West, prior to sharing which superstar players we'll be watching the most throughout the 2025 NBA playoffs and who we believe will represent their conference for the right to capture the Larry O'Brien Trophy in the NBA Finals this coming June. Now, we'll take some time to highlight the 1-versus-8 and 2-versus-7 matchups in the East and West that we know you'll be watching closely in round one, in addition to also sharing our key takeaways following all of the opening games to take place this past weekend. Yet, before we get into each series, let's show some appreciation to the marquee performers that opened up the playoffs in grand fashion as part of our opening tip-off segment. Starting with a triad of teammates that provided a show for fans out in the land, en route to drawing first blood against the Miami Heat on Easter Sunday, and Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, and Ty Jerome of the Cleveland Cavaliers as the three guards who became the first trio in Cavs history to score 27-plus points in a playoff outing during Game 1, also became the first guard triumvirate to record 25-plus points in a postseason game since Stephen Curry, Klay Thompson, and Jordan Poole of the Golden State Warriors did so back in 2022. On the way towards an NBA championship. In addition to a valuable teammate beside Anthony Edwards on the Minnesota Timberwolves, who you can always find him shouting out for his play in post-game press conferences, and Jaden McDaniels, who joined the Hall of Famer Kevin Garnett in the record books during their Game 1 win against the Los Angeles Lakers, is the only players in Timberwolves history to have a playoff game with 20-plus points without attempting a single free throw or committing a turnover. And last but not least, the man knows in the 313 know by nicknames such as Motorcade and Cade Icewood. And that's Cade Cunningham of the Detroit Pistons. The number one pick in the 2021 NBA draft became the first Piston since the days of Chauncey Billups back in 2004 to record at least 30 points and 10 rebounds in a playoff contest as the all-star guard and favorite for most improved player, poured in a team-high 33 points beside 12 boards that helped Detroit snap an NBA record 15-game postseason losing streak and draw even with the New York Knicks in their best-of-seven series out East. As the Game 2 victory marks the Pistons' first playoff win since Game 4 of the 2008 Eastern Conference Finals when they took down the Celtics. In addition to this, we got a chance to watch the icon and Stephen Curry of the Warriors become the oldest point guard to score 30-plus points in a playoff outing, and Golden State's win against Houston to open up their series, not to mention Paolo Banchero of the Orlando Magic also becoming the fastest player in the history of the 36-year-old franchise to reach 200 career playoff points as the All-Star forward accomplished the feat in just his eighth postseason outing in Game 1 versus the Celtics in Boston on the way to a 36-point afternoon, while we also received the news prior to Game 2 of Pistons, Knicks, and Clippers Nuggets that Landry Fields is out as general manager of the Atlanta Hawks, and Anzi Sala will be promoted in Fields' place as the franchise begins its search to find the president of basketball operations. I know we got a ton to get into surrounding these playoffs, Torrence, but what are some of the top storylines or recent happenings you've seen around the NBA that's managed to stand out to you over the last several days or so?
I'm gonna just keep it off the current games just for a second and piggyback off that last statement about Landry Fields being out in Atlanta. As an NBA fan who loves the on-court product, I'm also a fan of everything that takes place off the court. And right now, we got a lot of great stuff bubbling, man. We know that Zion getting moved this summer. We know KD getting moved this summer. We know that the Atlanta Hawks are going to be looking for somebody new in the front office. We know that there's going to be a few coaches gone. We got a few teams in the first round of the playoffs that if they don't manage to get out of the first round, we can add a couple more superstars to that list of guys that may be getting moved. Offseason's looking great, but this playoffs is looking like it's going to be one to remember as well. So let's all just stay focused. We'll have time to get there when season's in.
I know we got a ton to get into in this week's episode as far as it pertains to the playoffs, and I'm going to make sure that I try and keep my points in the opening tip-off segment as brief as I possibly can this time of year, especially with the postseason upon us. But I got to address this situation with the Sacramento Kings, man. Just a couple seasons ago, this franchise broke what was the longest active playoff drought in the four major North American sports leagues after capturing a top three seed in the Western Conference. And they really appeared to have a sense of direction under head coach Mike Brown, who captured Coach of the Year honors unanimously for his work during the 22-23 campaign, which marked his inaugural year under the helm out there in Sacramento, while De'Aaron Fox went on to become the first recipient of the NBA Clutch Player of the Year award that same season, beside general manager Monty McNair, who also took home Executive of the Year a year's end as well. And some of us thought the best was yet to come from this franchise that seemed as if they were on the up and up for the first time since that Mike Bibby, Chris Webber, Peja Stojakovic, and Vlade Divac era under the Hall of Fame head coach Rick Adelman. You fast forward a couple years later, and we see the firing of Mike Brown just a few days after Christmas. De'Aaron Fox letting it be known that he wasn't open to signing a long-term extension with the Kings, and when his time came in free agency, that he was likely going to chuck the deuces to go elsewhere, which led Sacramento to trade him to the San Antonio Spurs prior to the conclusion of the trade deadline this year a few months ago. And as soon as the 24-25 Kings season came to a close, we get the news that Monty McNair is out as the general manager in Sactown after the two sides mutually agreed to part ways after spending the last 5 years in California State Capitol. Just 3 weeks after, the assistant general manager, Wes Wilcox, left the Kings to become general manager of the men's basketball squad at the University of Utah. Now, former Knicks GM Scott Perry has been called upon to take over as GM out of Sacramento. The same man who once asked whether or not the main player that the Kings acquired back in the Fox trade and All-Star wing Zach LaVine truly impacted winning when he stepped onto the Hoop Genius podcast with BJ Armstrong and Mo Muncy a couple years back. And oddly enough, might have shared the same sentiment about LaVine as Monty McNair, who, according to recent reports, did not want to trade for LaVine. It was also said to be vehemently against the firing of Mike Brown, which is said to be the reason why McNair might have very well been pushed out of the door by owner Vivek Ranadive. Now, Torrance, you know there's another team that got dispatched in a play-in we're familiar with that I could get into right now if I wanted to. And sooner or later, I'll make sure to address them. But things such as these arise. A lot of players around the league view Sacramento as one of the worst organizations in the NBA. It's going to be real interesting to see just what Scott Perry decides to do as it pertains to LaVine this offseason. But even in the event LaVine is dealt, and they moved Domantas Sabonis to clear up cap space, the question still remains as to whether or not you can trust this Kings organization to get things right in a Pacific division that, as we know, torn, not going to do them no favors. And I'm sure you have your convictions on it beside others, but it just goes to show you how quickly things tend to turn in the NBA and how ownership can oftentimes be a franchise's own worst enemy when it comes to trying to build a perennial winner. And speaking of GMs real quick, how about Nico Harris and the Dallas Mavericks, the man who traded away Luka Doncic to the L.A. Lakers and continues to discuss it most recently in his exit interview days after Dallas's elimination and a loss to the Memphis Grizzlies during the play-in tourney for the right to the number 8 seed out West? It's obvious that The media is trying to paint him as the fall guy for all of this. And it's a bullet that he's going to have to bite for the rest of his career as an executive. However, it's not worth speaking on anymore at this point. It's what's done is done now. And as for Nico Harrison, my advice to him is this. Just place your focus on the upcoming draft and what lies ahead for next season to ensure that you can build a quality squad beside the man you wanted all along in Anthony Davis.
A question for you.
Yeah.
Well, quick questions. One, do you feel like the Sacramento Kings are the worst organization in the NBA? Like, if you were a player, would there be an organization that you would want to go to any less than them?
I would say outside of the Pelicans.
Yep, that was the other team I had in mind.
Outside the New Orleans Pelicans, yeah, they're among the worst. Love their fan base. Great fan base, very passionate, but the ownership in the front office never been aligned, and in turn, it affects the product that you see on the floor.
Yeah, I was like, these are the obvious two teams to move to Vegas and Seattle, in all honesty. Sell the teams to somebody that cares, that got the money, and move the teams. Guys don't want to go to those two places. You're at a disadvantage. No one wants to go to Sacramento. No one wants to stay in New Orleans. They have bad luck. It's time to go.
I know that's a conversation that we've had many a days off the record, and I appreciate you bringing it to the forefront for our audience, but you know me, like, I find it hard to see teams relocate just personally, and in Sacramento especially, because I really believe if it's done right, even though I understand they are California's third NBA team, and that actually fourth NBA team, at this point, because you got the Clippers that have emerged over the last 14 to 15 years. But I really believe, man, like, if you get that shit right, you can have something there.
Nah, that's
because
the nostalgia
the fan support. The fan support has always been excellent in that market.
Those people will become Warriors fans if they haven't converted already. I mean, lighting the beam was cool, but it's over now. Y'all traded De'Aaron Fox and Tyrese Halliburton. I'm not a fan of the last guy. It was a players poll that came out, and players ranked him as the most overrated player in the league.
Yeah, so, in the Athletic. I saw that earlier.
Yeah, so I was like, well, I know I'm not a hater, and that was good confirmation. I let other people do the hating. I just know what I saw. But if I was a fan of the Sacramento Kings, that would hurt, because it's like, man, who can we actually keep of value? See, most people keep thinking of the Kings in the early 2000s competing with the Lakers, but we never look at the truth of the situation. That was them catching lightning in a bottle. Chris Webber was a guy who had superstar talent but could never quite find a home in the NBA. And you do that his career over 100 times, he won't end up in Sacramento. Vlade Divac was already a 10-plus year veteran from the L.A. Lakers and the Hornets prior to getting there. You caught lightning with Jason Williams and Mike Bibby. And you had other guys like Carlos Williamson and Keon Clark and Bobby Jackson. Like, we really talking about 2-3 years of, oh, this amazing fan base. Well, if you always sucked the 20 years before and you were going to suck the 20 years after, I'm sure that you would love those 3-4 years in between. But it's time to just shut the operation down and just do the right thing.
You know, the thing I can't understand as we discuss the Kings, when Monty McNair came over there, that's the guy that I'm very familiar with because he was second in command under Daryl Morey in the Houston Rockets front office during the mid to late 2010s. And when he came over there, with some cachet. He turned the franchise around and made it a respectable enough franchise. Like, they just happened to win 40-plus games over the last three consecutive seasons. I believe prior to him coming over, they had one of the worst winning percentages in all of the league. And he bought them a respectable brand of basketball, guided them with the moves that he made into the NBA playoffs back in 2023 for the first time in nearly 20 years. I believe it was a 17-year-long playoff drought. To just part ways with somebody like that, alongside of Wes Wilcox, who, might I add, at one point in time was a major player in the Hawks front office, guys that are well-respected in the industry, like, man,
They have the worst owner in the league also. On top of that, I would recommend that every team in the league stop hiring Daryl Morey and his associates. There is no proof of concept of a championship coming with that mindset on building franchises or building basketball teams. Yeah, you get, you know, you like you said, you build a respectable team and all of that, but there's never any level of sustainability. These teams end up lacking chemistry. Because even like right now, you look at the Sacramento example. We know DeMar and Zach don't like playing together, yet they end up on the same roster again. Keegan Murray, his development has been all messed up. You haven't put a proper center next to Domantas Sabonis. See, teams like the Kings, they always stay between that 35 to 40 win range because they'll take talented bad contracts over and over.
I understand what you're saying, but when you bring up McNair, McNair reportedly didn't want LaVine in the mix. Reportedly didn't even want DeRozan. And I believe, according to reports that's been out there, have been coming to the light over the last couple of weeks, Vivek Ranadive had a lot of input on moves that went down over the last year and some change. It was also said that Zach LaVine happened to be Vivek Ranadive's favorite player, which is part of the reason why the deal went down. And even though Monty McNair came from Daryl Morey's regime, who I know a lot of people have a mixed bag of opinions on, and I understand both sides, I thought for the most part, he was trying to build something there. We talked about it when they fired Mike Brown prior to 2025 kicking in, that we didn't understand the direction this franchise was trying to go, and we sure as hell talked about it at the trade deadline, and now it's becoming clear by the day that the ownership and the front office were never on the same page, which has really, as of late, become a league-wide theme on a ton of levels, man.
I mean, bro, they their owner hired Vlade Divac to run the team at one point. They passed on Luka Doncic. At one point, Vivek was open to the idea of playing 4-on-5 on a defensive end and keeping one guy on offense cherry-picking as an offensive system. I'm all for free thinking and open-mindedness, but their owner is insane. And when you have an insane owner, there are going to be insane decisions being made. That franchise will never have stability as long as he's the owner.
All right, let's move away from the opening pleasantries to get into these opening round matchups going down in this year's NBA playoffs, beginning with the 1-8 matchup out in the Western Conference between the Memphis Grizzlies and the Oklahoma City Thunder, where in the series opener, we got to see a Thunder squad seek to send a message not only to the Grizzlies in an early afternoon tip-off to close out the weekend, but to the rest of the national audience who, just like us, watched a beatdown on Sue in Game 1 as OKC defeated Memphis by 51 points to mark the largest Game 1 margin of victory in NBA playoff history. You know, for a team whose starting five had not taken the floor together in 12 days prior to the opening tip of Game 1, Torrance, the Thunder certainly did not look as though they had much rust to shake off, as the defense was able to force a total of 24 turnovers by the Grizzlies, which they turned into 24 extra points on the other end, as OKC would go as far as 13 deep within their rotation and watch every player outside of Alex Caruso score the ball at least once in a game, where SGA scored only 15 points and didn't even need to have the typical output we become accustomed to seeing from him. Game 2 of this series is getting ready to take place on the date we're currently recording this. We'll have gone final by the time we officially release this to the public. But based on what we saw in Game 1, is there any way Memphis can even manage to garner a game or provide some level of challenge to an OKC squad that managed to throw the first knockout blow in this series?
Well, the first thing Memphis has to do, which at this point, it's hard to say they'll be capable of. Number one, they got to rebound the ball better. They got to win that matchup within that 5 feet around the rim. That's what wins championships in the league, defense and rebounding. Jaren Jackson is not a great rebounder. That's going to hurt them in the long run. Zach Edey, he's still a rookie. Not that quick, not that agile, but he's capable of getting some boards. They got to make a concerted effort to try to do better on the rebounding front. Secondly, this will be a common theme throughout this episode. Bench production. OKC scored 51 bench points. Memphis, they did pretty good compared to a lot of other teams over the weekend. I believe they had over near 40 points on the bench. Wasn't that big of a discrepancy, but you got to get something from those other guys when Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, they're both struggling, and that's who you're counting on to keep pace with Shea and the guys on OKC. Can they get a game just off the talent of Ja Morant? I believe so, but this looking like a five-game series in all honesty at best, because a game like game one is pretty demoralizing. It's not like your 20-point blowout. Like, we're talking about a 50-point game.
You talk about how demoralizing it is, and I don't think you're alone with that sentiment, as many people around the country would agree with you when you say that. Does witnessing these type of games alter the way that you watch series the rest of the way as a fan?
It would if I was to just go based on the outcome of game one as far as the score. Ja Morant is still one of the more exciting players in the league. I know that on their best day, Memphis and OKC can have a competitive matchup. But OKC kind of has things that Memphis lacks. Continuity, chemistry, a togetherness. Like, Taylor Jenkins was just fired recently. So we don't really know the stability of that locker room at this point. I'm going to watch, but they got until game three to keep my interest. I'll say that much.
When I look at Memphis, it's simple. The only way they're going to be able to steal a game is if they're able to generate some version of transition level offense. Oklahoma City, their defense is just too tough to have to grind out every single possession in the half court. You saw OKC rotate two premier perimeter players on the defensive end in Lou Dort and Cason Wallace on Ja Morant, and had a two other guys in Jalen Williams and Alex Caruso to utilize the play of Desmond Bane and Jaren Jackson Jr. Not to mention, we talk about a Thunder team that has a pair of solid rim protectors in Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein as the co-anchor. So if you beat that first line of defense, guess what? That second line, they coming. And if you're not able to run against this group, I believe that their chances of winning a game in this series is slim to none. Now, do I believe they can win a game off the back of Ja Morant, as Torrence said? Absolutely. He's capable of going off on any given night. And I would expect them to get off to a great start in game two, especially after getting punched in the mouth like that. You have to come out with some sense of urgency after getting your ass kicked like that. However, if you're going to commit 24 turnovers in a game, that's not going to help you either. And that's going to have to be part of the defensive plan as well, is how do we find a way to take care of the ball, and how can we find a way to win the first quarter? Because if you can't score efficiently against this defense, then you're going to have to keep them contained on the other end. And most importantly, utilize your best defense on the offensive end, which is taking care of the rock.
See, you brought up a great point when you said transition points. Because, like, when you look at the assist discrepancy, OKC 36 assists to Memphis's 18. Memphis didn't do a great job of shooting the ball because you're not able to create the mismatches that you need to break the defense down to create those good looks. Every time Josh switches, you try to get the switch, there's Lou Dort. Then there's still Shea at 6'6". Then there's still J-Dub. Then you got Chet or Isaiah at the rim. So, yeah, the transition part is definitely key, but that comes with how is Memphis going to get stops. You got to get stops to get out in transition, and then goes back to what I said about rebounding. And OKC, they seem like too disciplined of a team to really let Memphis let that happen. They take care of the ball. Shea's always playing at a pace he likes to play at, and he's always the guy that's in control of the ball. And he doesn't have to do all the scoring, which was a great, I won't say revelation, because we've all been watching this team all season, but when you got multiple guys that can knock down shots, It makes it hard to guard. Even still, we still know that they're gonna we're gonna have the 35-40 point Shea game. I don't see where Memphis gets more than one game.
Yeah, it's gonna be tough. I definitely don't see this being a 6-game series. I sure as hell don't see it being a 7-game series. And at best, it's a 5-game series, and it possibly can end in a sweep. Because if it's one thing I will give Oklahoma City credit for, over the last year or so that they've been in these playoffs, they typically tend to take care of business against their first round opponent. The only difference is the Pelicans didn't have a Ja Morant that can make life a living hell on them from time to time. This Grizzly squad does. I still believe that they get a game in this series. Outside of that, I can't see too much more.
Yeah, and I know we keep trying to make the Ja Morant point, like guys just don't struggle for an entire series, but we've seen it before. Like, I always think about that year Damian Lillard played the Pelicans in the playoffs, and we just kept waiting on the Dame game to happen, and we just started to realize, like, nah, they've game planned to shut him down, and that's just what's going to happen. You shut Ja Morant down, who would you be afraid of on Memphis to take over a game? You won't be, because even Jaren Jackson, he's near 7 feet tall, but he believes he's a shooting guard. So you're not even winning a physical matchup anymore either.
And you bring up Jaren Jackson Jr. Here's his stats from game one. Playoff low, 4 points, only 3 rebounds, shot 2 of 13 from the floor in 29 minutes. That's not going to cut it.
And one personal foul. My pops used to sound crazy because he got an old school basketball mentality, but he used to say crazy stuff like, if my power forward don't use 4 fouls in the game, then something went wrong. And at this point, I kind of agree with him when it comes to Jaren Jackson, who's known for fouling, but it's like, bro, do something. You can't have a game like that. Like, you just can't. If you're not going to score the ball well, go get double-digit rebounds. Go block some shots. And if all else fails, hey, lay a hard foul on Shea or something. Just show the team something. Right now, I'm in that locker room. I'm disgusted. I'm not going to lie. I'm disgusted with his performance.
We talk about this Grizzlies squad, a franchise that sat among the top of the Western Conference 2 out of the last 4 seasons. And at one point in time this season, just prior to the All-Star break, slid downward just shortly thereafter. Many people once viewed this Memphis squad as a team that had the capability of linking up with this Oklahoma City squad in later rounds of the Western Conference playoffs, as opposed to the first round as we're seeing now. We already know the Grizzlies' chances of winning this series is slim to none with the perimeter stoppers the Thunder have to make life hard on Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, and Jaren Jackson Jr. What are your thoughts on the overall national rhetoric as it pertains to the Memphis Grizzlies? And the reason why I ask you this question is because it was a podcaster who shall not be named, that's part of a major podcast network, that has some shit to get off his chest, so to speak. And he's a well-respected guy in the NBA ranks. But I just find it interesting how the rhetoric around this team has changed. And while I understand some of it you can say is self-inflicted, that guys may have bought it on themselves, what do you make of it?
It's two things. One, when Dylan Brooks did the whole back and forth thing with Bron, and they didn't necessarily respond in the best ways in defeat, they lost a lot of their national support from that standpoint, because they were the darlings that OKC were just a couple of years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah, when Ja decided to be Ja Wick and whatever other nicknames you guys have for him, I don't think people were bothered by that, but the expectations on winning became more apparent. Like, if you're going to act out, you got to win some games and prove your worth. And now that Luka's gotten traded, it's put it out there that, hey, do you really want to give some of these guys 300 plus million? I look at it like this. The NBA now, you got a 3-year window. That's the window. Yeah, it might take 3-4 years to build up to said 3-year window, but once you kind of like step into that 3-year window, that's it. And right now, I believe what Memphis might be in the third year of that window. Dylan Brooks has been on the team, the Rockets, for 2 years now. He was there in Memphis the last year, 3 years ago. And that's when they pretty much had the hype begin around them. And now they've plateaued. They fired the coach, because we all know that when you're ready to break a team up, the coach goes first. Then your second or third star on the team goes. So, yes, we look forward to Jaren Jackson and Desmond Bane to be in trade discussions this summer. Or they might just jump from the top rope and throw Ja in there. I don't think that guy's necessarily wrong. I mean, you only win one playoff series in this stretch with all the fuss around the team. Yeah, it's going to be pretty hard to justify. Everybody's not satisfied with a team that consistently makes the playoff. When you got a superstar, the word championship star is getting thrown out there prematurely.
We talked about the 1-8 matchup in the West. Well, let's get into the one out in the East between the Miami Heat and Cleveland Cavaliers as we witness Cavs head coach Kenny Atkinson shorten his rotation up just a bit in game one. However, it didn't stop Cleveland's sixth man of the year finalist and Ty Jerome from being the ultimate star in his role as he exploded for 28 points on 10 for 15 shooting, all the while proving to be the man to break Miami's infamous zone defense by knocking down three out of his five trades in the fourth quarter to stave off the Heat late. As the Cavs will go on to win 121-100, we saw the all-star backcourt duo of Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland combine to score 57 points in the win for Cleveland. Bam Adebayo and Tyler Hero each finished the series opener with 20-plus point nights for Miami, but it wouldn't be enough. You can catch game two of this matchup out in Cleveland as well at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Central Time on NBA TV. Prior to the series shifting over to South Beach this upcoming weekend. Torrance, this was a series that we didn't get to discuss last week as we watched the Heat go on the road last week and knock off the Bulls and Hawks in the play-in tourney for the right to capture the number 8 seed and square up against a Cavs squad that finished the year with the second-best record in the NBA. What are some of the things that you'll have your eyes on when watching this best-of-7 matchup?
Well, my eyes won't be on this series much because there's a clear talent advantage on one side. Miami, they don't have nowhere near the talent of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Miami doesn't have nowhere near the size of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And once again, they don't have the bench production of the Cleveland Cavaliers. If anything, I'm just watching to see how dominant can the Cavs really be? You mentioned Mitchell and Garland putting up 57 in the backcourt. But I look at a guy like Evan Mobley, and I'm like, hey, bro, I need to see it. You only had 9.7 boards. Don't be out here under the Jaren Jackson act, man. You too talented for that. I understand Bam Adebayo down there, Khalil, where, you know, if anything, Miami, they're going to be physical on defense. They're going to play in that zone. But there's ways to break that zone. You see a lot of times teams throw that ball in the middle right around that free throw line area. You try to find guys in the corner for three, but guess what? A lot of times that lob is right there. You got to put yourself in a position to get those easy buckets. So more than anything, I'm really just trying to see how dominant can the Cavs be in a sweep. They need that confidence going forward in these playoffs because right now we looking at them in Boston in that conference finals. Not to just jump ahead, but that's the matchup we're looking forward to. And you got to, like, take care of business against these teams that's not supposed to be here.
No, 100%. And I think that is the main thing that fans need to have their eyes on when watching this matchup. Just how serious is Cleveland about trying to make this a quick series as much as possible? Because in game one, Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland, they look real fresh and active. They obviously made it a priority to get to the paint and hunt down Miami Heat All-Star guard Tyler Hero, specifically in isolation situations. The third man off the bench and Ty Jerome stepped up to the plate when he needed to, because late in that game, Miami went on a run. They hung around in game one. But then they switched from a man-to-man to that zone. And when they did, things looked like they could have turned, but Jerome did what he had to do, hit some big triples, made some plays scoring-wise enough to the point where they had to run a trap at Ty Jerome to get the ball out of his hands down the stretch. The one thing that I liked about the Cavs' performance, specifically Jerome, is that his stretch in the fourth quarter was so good that he was able to spot Donovan Mitchell a lot of minutes on the bench where he could just cool off and rest. But I appreciate the way that Donovan Mitchell came out in game one. We know he's one of the best scorers in game ones at the playoffs in the history of the league. And he came out, set the tone, was locked in defensively. You saw him fighting for loose balls, diving from time to time, pumping up the crowd. That's the things that you want to see. As far as for the Miami Heat, I do believe this is a team that's outmatched. However, we know with Coach Spo and company that they're going to keep trying to fight. With Miami, they're going to have to find a way to limit the turnovers and win the battle on the glass. If they can't do that, they're going to go home rather quickly. Me personally, I got Cleveland winning this series in five. But if they don't find a way to manage the glass and they commit turnovers left and right and they're not able to get the three ball falling like they did in game one, it's going to be a quick exit.
Well, see, here's the thing. They only had 14 turnovers in game one. Now, Cleveland had seven, so the Cleveland, of course, still won the turnover battle by a lot. But 14 turnovers is not really a lot of turnovers, with all things considered. They, like you said, they hit some threes. They got a good performance out of Davion Mitchell. Tyler and Bam gave them 20-plus points. They didn't have necessarily like a bad game or game plan. They just literally don't have enough. So I'm going with a sweep for this one.
And I understand why. And I'm not saying that Miami has enough at all. And the reason why I said, rather, that Miami needs to limit the turnovers, because you want to make it a priority to get more shots than Cleveland. That's the only way you might have a chance to steal a game. I know 14 isn't a lot, but you don't want to come out of games saying we had more turnovers than them. Because when that happens, you're allowing them to get additional shots, especially when you're getting outmanned and out-rebounded on the glass. And I'm curious to see just how quick will they go into their zone look in game two, especially when the Cavs have been a hot and cold team when it comes to shooting a three ball over the last month. So I'm curious to see whether or not Spo is going to seek to challenge the Cavs on that front and use that zone just a little bit earlier and a little bit more frequently in game two.
Evan Mobley and DeAndre Hunter. That's what the Cavs need to just – Like we got to get those guys going, because DeAndre Hunt didn't put any points on the board. And like I said, Mobley with only nine. Other than that, Kenny Atkinson, Donovan Mitchell, Garland, Jared Allen, even Max Strus, he hit his threes. I just don't see a reason for them to mess around. And I don't want to see the Miami Heat on my TV screen right now. I'm done with them. Like, dog, they play like a college basketball team. And I get it. They got limited resources, but I don't want to see that shit. It's time for the big dogs. Let's get through this shit.
You tired of that Jim Boeheim ass zone?
No more Heat culture talk. Have you noticed?
Okay, we've chronicled the Heat-Cavs matchup. Let's keep it out in the East and move from the top part of the bracket down to the bottom and discuss the 2-7 matchup going down between the Orlando Magic and the defending champion Boston Celtics. We got a chance to see a young Orlando squad, albeit without their lead guard in Jalen Suggs, overcome an early double-digit deficit and enter the locker room with a one-point lead at the half against the Seas behind enemy lines, thanks to the play of all-star forward Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner. But even despite the Magic holding the all-NBA duo in Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown to just 33 points combined on 14 for 36 shooting, the champs' depth will prove to be enough to help them prevail, as Derek White's 30-point afternoon on 7 for 12 shooting from downtown, beside Peyton Pritchard's 19 points on 6 for 8 shooting and just 25 minutes off of the bench, will be enough to help Boston cruise to a 17-point win and knock off an Orlando squad and search for a better offensive output come game two. And speaking of that one, you can catch game two, which will also take place in Boston at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central time this Wednesday on TNT, prior to the two teams heading out to Orlando for game three a couple of nights later on Friday. The series opener was a real physical battle between the two teams, Torrance, as we saw Jason Tatum favoring his right wrist down the stretch after the All-Star four took a hard fall after seeking to throw down a jam over Kentavious Caldwell-Pope in the fourth quarter of game one. Ben said that he's listed as doubtful for game two. This matchup features two of the top five teams in defensive rating during the regular season going toe-to-toe against one another. And while we expect the champs to move on when it's all said and done, which things do you think the fans listening in to us should be eager to watch out for when taking in this particular match?
This was funny because I'll say this much. If Orlando were going to win any game this series, this was the one. You got the great performance from Ben Carroll. Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum didn't have necessarily great scoring games. But you lost to Derek White and Peyton Pritchard. They were the dynamic duo of the day. If you're not going to be able to beat Derek White and Peyton Pritchard, I don't have much to look forward to on that other side. So I understand why Jason Tatum is listed as doubtful, because maybe we could afford to take a game or two off this series. Maybe this one goes to five or six just because, you know, we just going to give JT the time to heal up properly. Orlando, they can't score the ball. They're not a great shooting team. We know what the Celtics attempted 37 threes this game. We know that number is going to continue to rise as the games go on. This is just like the Cleveland-Miami series. I know we both are high on the Orlando Magic, but that season really didn't turn out that way this year. I know this was a matchup you was calling for at the beginning of the season. Hopefully to see this matchup in like the second round, if Orlando lived up to the potential they had. But unfortunately, they didn't this season. So once again, I'm looking at this. Really, it should be a sweep, but as we saw in the first game, Boston not really taking this team serious.
When I look at this series, I think if you're somebody that likes high energy on the defensive end, this is your series. If you're the type of fan that think guys in the league don't play defense and utilize physicality, this is your series. If you like offense, this is an ugly series on one side specifically, and that's with Orlando. There are going to be a lot of times in this series when you watch the Orlando Magic play where you're going to say, they need a point guard. And you know what? You're going to be right. Because when it comes to half-court execution, Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner have a mighty load to carry. And I think the biggest takeaway from game one is even when the Celtics seem to be stuck in limbo offensively, they got more than enough weapons on the offensive end to get them through this series. And that's saying a lot, considering the fact that you had Paolo Banchero put up 36 points. Franz Wagner also put together a solid outing in his own right, where he scored, I believe, 23 points to go alongside of 5 assists, shot 10 to 24 from the floor. Somebody got to step up outside of those two on Orlando. Otherwise, this is going to be a series that culminate in a sweep. But they just look like a team, man, that is stuck in the mud offensively. And they're going to be that way for the majority of the series. And the only damn way the Magic can find a way to steal a game is by forcing the Celtics in a live ball turnover and getting out in transition. It's the only way. But I don't know if they may be able to do that. It's still a matchup that I'm going to watch because I like to see young teams such as Orlando. But as Torrence said, this is a matchup that I thought would definitely happen around later than where we're getting it in the opening round.
And last point, Jason Tatum. This is the mark of a champion and an MVP. He didn't have the best shooting night, but he was the leading rebounder between both teams with 14 boards. You need guys to recognize what's missing on the court and step in. That's the true mark of a superstar.
And kudos to Jrue Holiday as well, because Derek White, as great of a defender as he is, Paolo Banchero had his way with him a little bit. But Jrue Holiday said, I got your back. And when he stepped up to the challenge, he held the Magic to 2-for-11 shooting with 5 turnovers as their primary defender in game one. That's a guy that the Magic may have to avoid in the isolation, because he's doing everything thus far to hold his own against some taller guys that he's matched up against in Franz Wagner and Paolo Banchero.
This is why we need five game series back, these last two series we just talked about.
I knew you was gonna say that shit. So let's get into another matchup we did not get the chance to discuss, as we were still awaiting to see who the number two seeded Houston Rockets would face in the opening round last week when we recorded, and now we know is the Golden State Warriors after defeating the Grizzlies in the play-in round to earn the number seven seed. The Dubs captured a 10-point win in game one against the Rockets out in Houston at the Toyota Center, as the all-star duo of Steph Curry and Jimmy Butler managed to combine for 56 of Golden State's 95 points on the night to help their squad take a 1-0 lead in the series, all the while beating Houston at their own game, as the Warriors would outscore the Rockets in transition by 12 points in the opening half of play in game one. Alperen Sengun posted a team-high 26 points to go beside nine boards for a Rockets squad whose youth and inexperience on the playoff stage showed a myriad of ways. However, Houston fought their way back in the game despite some offensive struggles from their backcourt tandem of Fred VanVleet and Jalen Green by crashing the glass, as the league's best offensive rebounding club in the regular season retained 47% of their offensive rebounds, which led to generating 22 second-chance points in the series opener. I think those who listen to the new 24 throughout the course of the season are quite familiar with this year's Rocket squad that features some of the top young talent in the league. We also know that plenty are familiar with the exploits of number 30, as well as Jimmy Butler and Draymond Green on the other side of things in this series on the Warriors. What were your immediate thoughts and takeaways after taking out the time to watch game one? And who do you think comes out on top in this best of seven matchup?
We give Ime Udoka a lot of grace. We hype him up a lot because of the turnaround the Celtics made and the turnaround this Houston Rockets team has made. But sometimes guys are a little bit too rigid, and sometimes you end up with a coach who wants to be the man of the locker room. We know over the previous offseason that James Harden wanted to come back to the Rocket. And when you look at this team and what happened and how James Harden has been playing, you're like, damn, James Harden might have been perfect for this roster. Fred VanVleet, he won't be an asset this series. I think that the Rockets need to go big as much as possible. As much as possible. I'm talking about to an extreme NBA 2K level where I'm putting Thompson and Jalen Green in the backcourt, and you might see lineups where Jabari, Sengun, and Steven Adams are in the lineup at the same time. Just try to overwhelm the Warriors with size. And everywhere Steph turns, hey, a lot of length. Same thing with Jimmy Butler. It's a lot of size. Cut off some of those driving lanes. Because offensively, they won't be able to get it done. Jalen Green's too inconsistent with his shooting. Fred VanVleet's too inconsistent with his shooting. They don't have a guy that they can put the ball in his hands and go get an easy bucket. And that's why you hear the Kevin Durant rumors with this team. They just don't have it. And as great of a job they do defensively, you still got to put the ball in the hole on the other end. Holding a Steph Curry team to 95 points should always equal a W. You neutralize Draymond's effectiveness to a certain extent. Like I said, they beat themselves pretty much. Their inability to score. You only hit six threes, but you took a 29 of them. And a lot of times, those aren't good looks. They have one of the worst half-court offenses just visually in the league in this postseason.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that kind of makes them similar to Orlando on a lot of levels when you talk about the half-court offense and the lack thereof out there in H-Town. One of the biggest takeaways that I took from game one is that the Warriors can lock up when they need to just as well as the Rockets can. Rockets didn't even score 50 points until the 4:36 mark of the third quarter. Their 85 points were the fewest this season. Rockets, I thought, got off to a nice start the first 4 to 5 minutes of the game. I like the way that Alperen Sengun sought to take it to Draymond Green and utilize his size advantage on the block. But Golden State kept hanging in there. You saw Stephen Curry begin to score inside the lane against aggressive defenders, finding the time to hit some crazy three-point shots over the tight duress of a Jalen Green and Amen Thompson. And then you saw Jimmy Butler start to pick and choose his spots late during closing time, and you understand exactly why they bought him. Yeah. Now on defense, I think Golden State has conceded allowing Sengun to score, but Sengun is gonna have to make it a priority when it's money time to do the same thing, because he only had 4 of his 26 points in the fourth quarter. You talk about how they went 6 for 29 from downtown, missed several shots around the rim. When I watched that game from Houston side, it's some guys that was on their bench that might have to have their number called in game two, if not game three.
Cam Whitmore.
Yep. And I'm glad you brought them up, because they're going to need some scoring. They're going to need some bucket getters. They're going to need some guys that can bring them some energy and punch off of the bench. And you might even have to put Jeff Green on the floor sometimes when the shots aren't falling, because you get a professional vet in there that can help these young guys a little bit. They're gonna have to call on some different dudes, man.
Yeah, I mean, I love Uncle Jeff. Uncle Jeff ain't gonna cut it this series. Look, they won the rebounding battle. We talked about that all with all of these matchups. That's where your advantage is at. Grind it out on defense and find a way to take advantage of your size on the other end. If you can force the Warriors to start double teaming Sengun at some point, and maybe guys like Jalen Green and Fred VanVleet can get easier buckets cutting to the rim onto backdoor, hitting their open threes. But other than that, it's going to be hard for them to just generate points just by the nature of their offense. They settle for a lot of bad shots, a lot of bad shots. They don't create shots very well. They're the team like that you've been mentioning transition points a lot. They're the team that they have the defense to create those transition opportunities, and they're going to have to take them. They're going to have to take them, because Jalen Green, a lot of potential, but this half court playoff basketball is why he's always kind of on a trading block with this team and this organization. But at the same time, I think Ime isn't the greatest offensive coach either.
And that's a fair assessment, because as we know, during those 2022 NBA Finals between the Celtics and Warriors, a lot of nights after games where you could pinpoint how certain things could have been handled much better on the offensive end from Boston's perspective between Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, that Joe Mazzulla did a great job of cleaning up. When I look at Jalen Green, he got to step it up. It's just plain and simple, man. Like, what he did in his playoff debut, that was one of the worst playoff debuts I've seen in quite some time. And I understand, you know, his shot profile leaves a lot to be desired. Hopefully, you know, he learns rather quickly from the film and adjusts, because at this stage, you got to come with it. And hopefully he's seeking to get downhill as much as he possibly can and not settling for those inconvenient shots time and time again. Because anytime you out-rebound a team by 17, you typically should win. And like you said, when you hold Golden State to under 100, that's usually a win in itself.
Fred VanVleet shot the ball 19 times. He had the most attempts on his team. That can't happen again.
Who you think come out on top?
We know who's coming out on top. Why are you asking a rhetorical question?
Do we? I mean, I've heard mixed answers on both sides, man.
That's
I get it.
That's us. That's us as people that enjoy basketball trying to sound smart. Look, the Warriors gonna win this series, man. It don't even matter how many games. Obviously, I'm a little irritated by that fact.
I know you are.
But I enjoy watching Steph play basketball though, so I'm not mad at that. All my Warrior slander never includes Steph.
And it's a part of me, I won't lie, that I would love to see Houston win it and get some revenge for, you know, the 2018 Western Conference Finals that went sour toward the end for personal reasons, you know.
I mean, yeah, you got your bias. But see, here's the thing about life, basketball. if Steph Curry was to lose, there's nobody on the Rockets who's going to be, like, elevated from this situation and be like, yeah, this is the next guy. Like, when Ant beat the Suns last year, it was like a thing. It was like, damn, you know, KD putting Ant over right now. That's not happening this series. Like, Steph going to take care of them. Steve Kerr, Draymond, like, this is the series where experience does matter.
And you might be right about that. I'm not going to dispute that. But I hope we can still get
That's
a
'cause
six
you
or
like the
seven game
Rockets.
series that's entertaining.
Yeah, you like the Rockets. Then I'm not a person that likes to deal with the impossible. Right at this moment, it feels impossible for the Rockets to win. So I'm not gonna put too much thought into it. It's gonna be over with soon.
I'm not gonna put much thought into it either, but I just want to see a fun competitive series,
Your heart,
and
your
it's
heart,
cool to see them. It's
your
cool to see
heart
them
is in
back in
it.
the playoffs for the first
Yeah,
time in 5 years.
it's not about thought with you. Your heart is in it. You love the Houston Rockets, and that's okay. I don't. So I'm able to be objectionable about this thing. This shit's gonna be over.
Now we've discussed the 1 versus 8 and 2 versus 7 matchups in detail for you. Now let's revisit those 3 versus 6 and 4 versus 5 matchups we took the time to highlight in last week's episode of the New 24, starting with the best of 7 series between the number 6 seeded Detroit Pistons and the number 3 seeded New York Knicks out in the East. Saw a playoff test the Knicks squad go on a 21-0 run midway through the fourth quarter to snatch the series opener out of the young Pistons' hands as Detroit entered the final frame with a lead, made Jalen Brunson work for his game high 34 points, but campaign contributed mightily off the bench to help New York in a major way, scoring 11 of his 14 points in that fourth quarter to help the Knicks take a 1-0 series lead. But Detroit bounced back and did not make the same mistake twice in game two, as Cade Cunningham's career night beside Dennis Schroder's clutch tray with less than a minute to go in regulation proved to be the defining moment that helped the Pistons draw even in the series with a 6-point win in Madison Square Garden, as the series now heads to the Motor City at Little Caesars Arena for games 3 and 4, as you can catch game 3 this Thursday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central Time over on TNT. Last week, when giving our official predictions on this series, Torrance, you said you were going with the Pistons in 7 games. I said the Pistons would do so in 6 games. What are your thoughts and takeaways thus far on the series through the first 2 games?
Number one, I'm disgusted watching Jalen Brunson play basketball. This is some of the most anti-playoff stuff I've seen. We still foul baiting in mid-April. Like, come on, bro. That's regular season basketball. And it's the Knicks and it's the Garden, and they were giving him that BS. But I get it. Karl Anthony Towns, he came up small. He only had 10 points this game. And we know that they're not gonna get much production from their bench. So if the refs are not gonna help, then I mean, the Knicks, they're gonna struggle. Now, what I did like was Cade Cunningham bouncing back. You struggle game one, game two, he had a much better game. I think one of the keys for the Pistons, if they can keep OG off of Cade, that's who he seemed to struggle with a lot during the first 2 games. If they can keep him off, then I think Cade can continue to be successful. I'm still keeping up with my prediction with 6 games because they still haven't shot the ball well either.
You
Detroit.
said 7, right?
Seven. I said seven. I did
Yeah,
say
I know I
seven.
said
Excuse me.
6, yeah.
You said six. I'm sorry about that.
It's all good.
Hey, man, it might be a Freudian slip, man. Maybe it does get done in 6 games because the Knicks, they disgust me, man. I don't really have much analysis. I was just thoroughly disgusted by what they were doing out there to generate offense at home, too. So I hope that Detroit crowd is bringing game 3 and 4, man. I would love to see Detroit go back to the Garden with a 3-1 lead. I think they can do it. They still haven't gotten certain guys to have good games yet. Malik Beasley, Tim Hardaway, Tobias Harris gave them some in game one.
I think he's been solid through the first 2 games for the
Yeah,
most part.
Tim Hardaway and Beasley, they're pretty good game one as well, but I expect them to pretty much bring it in game 3 and 4 at back at home. Overall, man, bro, I just real disgusted with the Knicks, man. Like, I really am. And that campaign game pissed me off too, game one. That's when I knew. I was like, yeah, the Knicks, bro, they really need a campaign in those 14 points.
Oh yeah, that was the big difference. In game one, without campaign going off the way he did in the final frame, they not taking game one. I believe Detroit played well enough for the most part to where you can make a case that they should be up 2-0 in this series. And you talk about Tobias Harris, for a guy that I don't even think is the number three option on this team. He's been rather solid the first 2 games. He's averaging 20 points in the series, nearly 10 boards a game. Shooting 58% from the floor, 55% from 3-point land, he's put together a hell of a series. And if he can continue to play like this, hey, and you get the other guys flowing and going, they could really make some noise back home in Detroit, going there to play their first home playoff game in six seasons. I've seen some of the activations that they're going to have in Little Caesars Arena on social media and stuff, and the fans are into it. I know my guy Brendan Welper been back and forth with me talking about it. I know he was real happy after the win at the top of the week. So I'm definitely eager to see what the festivities are like out there in the 313 in downtown Detroit. But overall, I've just been impressed with the resilience that the Pistons have been able to show. Like, when I saw game one, I know a lot of people were saying, hey, K got to be better. And they were right. No disputing that. But I think he had to get adjusted to the level of physicality in the playoffs. I think after going through that experience in game one, he came out aggressive like I expected him to and thought that he would. And he put together an impressive showing for himself. Now, of course, guys like Malik Beasley got to get it going. Isaiah Stewart being out, that's going to be a tough thing to navigate. But kudos to Paul Reed, you know, DePaul alum, for stepping up in his absence, giving him some steady minutes off the second unit. And Jalen Durant not getting in foul trouble as he did in game one and making a critical play late. I like the way Dennis Schroeder picked up the guys off the bench as well. Was a steady veteran presence in game two. As far as the Knicks, man,
Cat, yo,
man,
you said at the same time, bro.
You got to demand the ball, bro.
Yo,
you got to demand the ball. You getting a mismatch with Tobias Harris on you, and you got to seek to take advantage of that, because I watched these two teams meet up quite frequently during the regular season. And in the regular season, Jalen Durant was the guy that they matched up as the primary defender on Cat. Now they've been putting Tobias Harris on him. If they doing that, make them pay for it. And Jalen Brunson needs to be smart enough to recognize that as well. All this isolation ball, I understand that in the playoffs, it's going to be some critical jumps of the game where you got to go mano a mano. But they fall in love with that too much. And I saw the game that Jalen Brunson was playing, and I found it quite fascinating, because it's some players that I happen to watch that a lot of people will say they're foul grifters, but I ain't see them doing that shit.
Okay, so that's about to say, you were disgusted too, right? That's all. You ain't got to call it interesting.
I'll say this. I found it to be rather comical.
Just disgusting basketball, man.
Yeah, they gotta work on that one. The bench, I think that's the Pistons' strong suit. I think they have more than enough depth. I don't see why they can't win both games in Detroit as long as they take care of the basketball and continue to stay connected defensively, because out of the eight quarters played in this series thus far, I think you can make the argument that the Pistons have been the better team for seven out of eight of them.
Yeah, but I still feel like it's going seven, just because Cat, we know he's the every other game type of guy. So I expect him to have a big game in either three or four, make it interesting. Realistically, out of all of these series, this is probably the one I'm expecting to go back 2-2. But they definitely have the room to get both in Detroit. It's definitely there for the taking. But they still a young team, so I don't know if they'll have that discipline.
Yeah, for sure. That's always going to be the big question with Detroit in this series. You notice that they first go around as a collective. And even though they got some vets that's been in the playoffs, such as Malik Beasley, Dennis Schroeder, and Tobias Harris in recent years, the core members of this team is still learning what it takes on the fly to try and win. And I definitely expect Cat to have a big performance on the road. Hell, he's going to have to if the Knicks want to steal a game out in Detroit and get home court advantage back in their favor. All right, now, let's get into the 3-versus-6 matchup out in the West going down between the Minnesota Timberwolves and Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers got off to a hot start in the opening minutes of game one as they held an 8-point lead courtesy of Luka Doncic, who at one point in the outing had more total points on the night than Minnesota during the first quarter. Yet once that second quarter came, we saw the Timberwolves go on a run and not look back, as Minnesota led by as many as 27 points during the contest and dominated Los Angeles on the glass en route to hitting 21 three-pointers to set a franchise postseason record for most triples in a single game, as Jaden McDaniels and Naz Reid, who you told fans to watch out for prior to the start of this series, and pointed out how he always has big games against the Lakers, Torrance, combined for 48 points while shooting 76% from the floor, as the Timberwolves bench outscored the Lakers bench by 30 points in the series opener. We know game two of this series is getting ready to take place on the date we're currently recording and will have gone final once this episode has dropped, just like Memphis, Oklahoma City, and Milwaukee, Indiana. But what were your key takeaways from game one? And what adjustments do you think the Lakers need to make to not only draw even, but to regain control of this series?
All right, let's start at the top. LeBron, guy whose career averages are 27-7-7. I tweeted during the game, hey, I need you to focus on that 7-7 part. And not just statistically, but what I mentioned about Jason Tatum. That you got to recognize where your team needs help and lock in there. They needed help on the boards. I was like, Bron, you gotta step in and get help on those boards. They don't have much size, but you're physically still bigger than majority of the players on the court. Luka showed in the first quarter that he can handle the scoring for long stretches of the game if need be, but they needed somebody to fill in those gaps. I said it at the trade deadline. Dorian Finney-Smith, he's been a great addition to the team. But, hey, we need you to knock down open shots. He only had 3 points. They didn't get any production from the bench whatsoever during this game. And also, we got to find a way to get Austin Reeves easier shots. See, the thing with this Timberwolves team is when they go big, and by big, I mean putting Anthony Edwards at the point guard spot and take Mike Conley out the game, you got Jaden McDaniels and Alexander Walker out there defensively. There is no switching to a favorable matchup at that point. And we know that Rudy's in the paint, and I already told you guys, hey, Bron struggles when Rudy's in the game. It is kind of one of his Achilles heels in the league. They got to find a way to get easier shots. Now, I heard J.J. Redick say he felt like they probably could have been better prepared for this game. They didn't practice much. I still got faith in the Lakers because this Timberwolves team, they're the type of team to find a way to lose games themselves. But if they stay locked in, this series can go in a different direction than I originally thought.
I know prior to the start of this series, I said the Lakers would take down the Timberwolves in 6 games. I still feel as though that they can, but the effort defensively, it has to be better. And they look like a team that hadn't touched the floor in a few days, if you want to know the truth. Rotations, a step far too slow. And the starting center for the Lakers, Jackson Hayes, he played only 8 minutes. And you saw J.J. Redick opting to run Vanderbilt at the five and using his activity to try and, you know, serve as a pest to Minnesota. And they cut the lead at one point to as many as 12. But J.J. Redick got a decision to make, in my opinion, as to whether or not he wants to give Jackson Hayes a second look or make his first true chess move in this showdown and seek to go small from the start and seed in the size advantage. We know that the Lakers are no stranger to playing small and that there was a period in time shortly after the Anthony Davis, Luka Doncic trade where the defense was solid. And they look like a top 5 to 10 defensive unit. Can they get that effort? Because if they can, even in spite of the size disadvantage, they'll have a chance. And yeah, you're right. They're going to have to find a way to create some easier opportunities for Austin Reeves. And LeBron is definitely going to be needed on the defensive end. I believe that his scoring output will increase in game two. I'm not worried about that. But I don't believe that LeBron necessarily has to be the main guy on a nightly basis scoring-wise to help the Lakers prevail in these matchups. But I give kudos to Chris Finch for making sure that his guys were prepared in game one. And the biggest lesson that I take away from Minnesota, as I did last year watching them in the playoffs, is their biggest defense is their offense. Because when they hitting shots and guys are getting opportunities in transition, forcing turnovers and so forth, it ignites their defense. And you see it time and time again. This game kind of reminded me of game two against the Nuggets last year in the Western Conference semifinal, where once you get to like the second quarter and that bench unit comes in, they turn some shit up, and before you know it, opposing team to call the timeout, and it feels like the game is already decided at that point.
Yeah. And like I said, it's just a matter of will they stay focused? Because when you watch game one, if LeBron and Luka, if you weren't just enamored with them as star players, you'd say that Minnesota is clearly the better team. You're like, okay, yeah, LeBron, Luka at the top, and Anthony Edwards. But then when you start looking at the rest of the rosters, the rest of both teams, yeah, Minnesota has a clear talent advantage.
Yeah, and the thing that the Lakers got to do a better job of, too, is, like, how many wide-open three-pointers you going to allow? Like, the way they treated Naz Reid, just going back looking at the highlights, man, he got a lot of open looks.
It's been like that.
A lot of open looks.
It's been like that for years with that guy against the Lakers. They just somehow managed to always lose him in the rotation. And there's a particular couple of guys in that starting lineup who's responsible for that. Rui and LeBron got to communicate better. You need to just keep somebody at Naz Reid's hip. Because he just gets these, like, a lot of these threes are either in transition from down the middle, or like I said, they lose him in rotation and he's able to get open in the corner. If you're going to leave somebody open for three on the Timberwolves, it's Jaden McDaniels.
Right. Yeah, because Naz Reid damn sure isn't the guy to leave open. He sure as hell made them pay in game one. And that's a guy that they need to really highlight in film study to not just leave wide open as though he's a he's with us guy, as they say in basketball terminology, meaning that, hey, we want him shooting a three and we can live with him doing it.
And Bron got to be aggressive too, finding easy shots for himself too. Because a lot of times when you notice it a lot more this season, especially since Luka got there. It's like Luka and AR get off, and then you will just see stretches of the game where Bron is just trying to force the offense. And it's like, bro, relax, get some easy buckets, or come out aggressive early and get it out the way. But I don't like when I see Bron trying to play catch-up statistically.
And then we had a 4-5 showdown in the East between the Central Division rivals and the Milwaukee Bucks and Indiana Pacers. Pacers' depth proved to be too much for the Bucks to handle in the series opener as Indiana's defense managed to hold everyone beside Giannis Antetokounmpo in check by holding his castmates to under 35% shooting from the floor, in addition to spreading the wealth on the other end of the court as well, as the Pacers' balanced attack would lead to five players finishing the afternoon in double figures, led behind Pascal Siakam's 25 points alongside of 7 rebounds and 7 assists. Giannis Antetokounmpo posted 36 points and 12 rebounds on the way to shooting 14 for 23 from the floor for Milwaukee. The Bucks now shift their focus to game two as they look forward to the return of their all-star guard Damian Lillard, who will make his way back for the first time after being sidelined for over a month due to suffering a blood clot in his right calf, and try to provide Milwaukee with some much-needed help on the offensive end after the supporting cast went cold in game one. I know prior to the start of this series that I said the Pacers would win in 7 games based upon Lillard's status at the time. You scoffed at that notion, saying you rolling with the Bucks in 6. We don't know how Dame Dolla might fare in his return. However, I think we'd agree that even with his insertion back into Milwaukee starting five, that they're going to need a third man to give them some steady offense they can rely on to take control of this series. One of those guys we thought was capable of being that third scorer entering the series in Kyle Kuzma went scoreless despite garnering 22 minutes of floor time in game one. What do you think the Bucks must do to regain some momentum prior to heading home for game three?
Shit, you talking about Kyle Kuzma, Torian Prince played 20 minutes and had a donut too. Yeah, two starters not giving you any offensive production. That's terrible. The guy who really impressed me was, what's his name, Nembhard?
Andrew Nimhart.
Andrew Nimhart. His first name always throws me off because who names their kid Andrew? Sorry to any Andrews out there. The Pacers just getting out in transition, creating easy shots for themselves. And you pointed this out last episode. When I watched the game, they played great defense for stretches of the game. They really did. I was really impressed by the way they played defense. Torian Prince and Kyle Kuzma, they got to give the Bucks something. Giannis came with it. You got solid games from Gary Trent, Kevin Porter, Green. It's those two guys. You can't have guys playing that many minutes and not giving you any scoring production. You simply can't. And we know that the Pacers at their best, they bring a well-balanced attack. So it really puts pressure on the other guys on your team to step up in those situations. I look like an idiot right now, man, picking the Bucks. I'm not going to lie. Didn't look good. It really didn't, man. Like, anytime you see Dame arguing with Halliburton, when you see, stuff like that, that's a guy that knows that his team needs him in a major way. That's it, man. That's all I got to say, man. Like, I'm going to just let this series play out because right now I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about in regards to this series, clearly.
I'll say this, when it came to the confrontation between Damian Lillard and Tyrese Halliburton, that shit go all the way back to the NBA Cup semifinal last year out in Las Vegas, where Tyrese Halliburton was, skipping up and down, and Dame, felt the way about it. I knew right then and there in that moment that Damian Lillard was going to try and make his way onto the floor for game two. That I did know, because I never seen him act like that as a bystander on the bench. And I can understand why he was ticked off by it a little bit, because as we know, Tyrese Halliburton do have a tendency to talk
front
a lot of
run.
Shit when he
Yeah,
up.
Front
Yeah,
run.
He the ultimate front runner. Yeah, and I was going to say that. Like, that's what he is on a lot of levels. We saw that most notably last year in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Semis against the New York Knicks. Taking it back into this series, Torian Prince, like you said, went scoreless, but only took one shot. That's the problem, too. You got to do more than take one shot. I know you're not the main man in Giannis Antetokounmpo, and I know you're not Damian Lillard, but when no Damian Lillard is out there and you know your main star needs some help, you got to do something, man. Just only taking one shot, that's unacceptable. They didn't really look like a team that was ready to play. The person that you got to point out for that is Doc Rivers. You got to do it. You just got to do it, man. And I love Doc, don't get me wrong. But, man, them guys did not look prepared to play at all in game one. After the half, it was one of those games where I was like, you know what? I've seen all I need to see, because these guys, man, they not cutting it.
Hey, man, Doc Dollar forgot he was the coach. He in the press conference talking about, Kyle struggled because, you got to get the ball. Well, that's your job, is to make sure he get the ball, player. See, Doc already throwing blame around after game one wasn't a good sign, man. That's what Doc usually do after the series over. He game one, he in mid-postseason form.
Yeah, I think in order for the Bucks to regain control of this series, it's going to come down to what Dame can provide them with, because they're going to need his shot making. And even though Kevin Porter scored in double figures, he was 2 for 7 from the floor. But he did a good job of getting to the line, to his credit. But, like, A.J. Green, he's been solid off and on off the bench. But they're going to need several guys to step up. Because I really believe if the several guys on the roster, whoever they may be, can step up beside Giannis, who's going to get his, you can make it a series.
Yeah, you can make it a series. Here's the thing. It was just game one. Game two is happening at the time of this recording. The Pacers are at home. Just because they might be down 2-0, it's not much to panic about. It's just the road games. The goal is to take one if you can. They just got to get the ball rolling between game two and the start of game three as to how they're going to keep the Pacers out of transition and how can they get easier shots in the half court. Because unlike the teams that we mentioned earlier, the Rockets and the Magic, that's what Damian Lillard is here for. Somebody that can also create shots in the half court. The funniest thing is, I don't know if Chris Middleton is healthy as of the time of this recording, but that's an area he was excellent for the Bucks over the years, was scoring in the half court, and they replaced him with Kyle Kuzma, who's not doing anything at all in that department.
And then we have the battle between a pair of teams where through the first two games in this series, each matchup has been decided by 3 points or less. And that's the number 5-seeded LA Clippers going up against the number 4-seeded Denver Nuggets in the West. One could say that the Clippers let the series opener slip away after blowing a double-digit lead and committing 5 turnovers in the clutch minutes of game one, which culminated in a tough overtime loss as the Brody and Russell Westbrook proved to be major down the stretch against his former teammates by hauling down offensive rebounds and hitting a trio of key three-pointers down the stretch, while Aaron Gordon, Jamal Murray, and Nikola Jokic combined to score 75 of the Nuggets' 112 points in the series opener. But L.A. would get their lick back in game two as Kawhi Leonard would follow up a 7-turnover outing in game one with one of his finest playoff outings in recent memory, scoring 39 points on 15-for-19 shooting and making a critical steal on a cross-court pass from Jokic to help the Clippers draw even in the best-of-seven showdown. As this heavyweight matchup now shifts to Inglewood, California for game three at the brand-new Intuit Dome, which is set for Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central Time, as you'll be able to see that one on NBA TV. You want to talk about a series that has provided us with close thrillers down the stretch, Torrance? This has been the one to do it. I know I asked you the same question when taking the time to discuss Pistons and Knicks, but what have been your overall thoughts and takeaways through the first two games between the Clippers and Nuggets thus far?
Hey, man, Zubac is doing a great job. That's the guy, man. He hasn't quite matched Nikola Jokic as far as production, but he's done enough to allow James Harden and Kawhi to really dominate the other matchups in this series. He's neutralized Jokic just enough. Jokic had 26 the last game, 29 game one. So he hasn't gone off for a 30-point game in this series. And if you leave it up to me, if I'm like Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. against Kawhi Leonard and James Harden, oh, I'm going to take that matchup every time. What I had the Clippers in six?
Yeah, we agreed on that one. I had the Clippers in six as well.
And once again, this is one of those series where you could argue that the Clippers should be up 2-0. They already took one in Denver. We know that hopefully this Clippers crowd comes out and brings the noise because, hey, this is what Ballmer built the building for. Kawhi got 2 days off. That's going to be big because he played, 41 minutes in game one. I didn't expect him to bounce back this way in game two, but he did. But Christian Braun's not going to be able to do anything with Kawhi Leonard. Jamal Murray won't be able to. Michael Porter won't be able to. And they've, like I said, they found a way to keep Nikola Jokic from having those dominant stretches that he tends to have during the games. He's been having to really put his production together quarter by quarter. Clippers looking good, man. Clippers are looking good. I'm going to keep talking shit about them, but they looking good right now. So I'm going to ISO out and, you know, let my man do his thing with his favorite players.
I'll say this. This has been a very fun series to watch. And this is the matchup where you want to watch every game and you don't want to miss a single minute of it, because in the fourth quarter, it's going to come down to which team can execute the best every single time. The one thing that does concern me watching this series from the Clippers' perspective of things is how Denver has found a way to obliterate them on the offensive rebound. And it's been many of possessions where the Clippers have strong defensive stances, but they can't finish them off due to their inability to rebound. When you do that, you're giving Denver so many extra chances to score. The Nuggets scored 18 second chance points at the top of the week in game two. So even though the Clippers didn't give up the 29 points off of turnovers as they did in game one, this was a game that came down in the wire and it almost burnt them a second time. So that has to stop. And for both teams in this matchup, it seems like whoever commits 20 turnovers or more is just going to lose. We saw the Clippers do that in game one. Saw the Nuggets do it in game two. So taking care of the basketball is going to be very important. It's been cool to witness the brilliance of Kawhi Leonard, who I tweeted something about after game one. And I said, when he looks at the film of this matchup, the series opener, he's going to be real pissed because it was a lot of reads that he was failing to make late down the stretch of that game. He didn't seem too confident with the ball in his hand a lot. And I think that's why they went to Harden a ton in the stretch of that one. But whatever it was, I'm sure he saw it and got riled up about it and came out and did the damn thing. And Tyronn Lue was talking about how they needed to get Kawhi back into attack mode again. He came out, hit his first six shots, missed the three, but then followed that up, hitting six more in a row. And it wasn't until the fourth quarter where he missed consecutive shots again. And it's just been cool to see how he's as close to as automatic of a score as he can be. And what's already turned into a very tightly contested series. It's just real fun and cool to see him playing at this level once again, especially when a lot of people have turned sour on him a little bit. And for some things that he can't necessarily control.
Yeah, and that's always a funny thing to me because you got fans who the playoffs are the only thing that matters. The playoffs are the only thing that matters. Well, look, this guy, hey, he only has but so many games and minutes in those knees year after year. And he's saving them for the important part of the year, and he's producing. I mean, between the two games, he's averaging 30 points a game. Now, what I would like to see in this series going forward, especially after game two, James Harden didn't take any free throws in game two. That's not like the beard at all. So if he can find a way to stay aggressive, keep guys involved, but more importantly, keep Kawhi playing at this level, hey, man, the Clippers, that six games is looking great. We know that at some point, Jokic is going, he going to explode. He going to get Zubac into some real foul trouble and put the Clippers in an awkward position, but it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. And shout out to, you know, Jeff Van Gundy and Ty Lue for, to the best of your ability, neutralizing Jokic as much as possible so far in this series.
Yeah, Zubac making Jokic work. He making him work. Like, he had seven turnovers in game two. And you could tell, like, he was making some haphazard decisions, and you could see it on his face emotionally after he made it. Like, damn, like, I really did that. You know, but Zubac has really been making him work. And Zubac is averaging what? As I had the numbers in front of me.
20 and 10.
Yeah, 19 points, 13 rebounds, shooting over 60% from the floor. If he just avoids staying in foul trouble, I think that he'll be fine. And he's really putting together a nice series for himself and showing why I said last week I found him to be one of the top three big men in the game this season.
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned, like, James Harden is, you already got Zubac doing work down low, making Jokic work. Now, if you can do a better job of putting Jokic on the perimeter in some of those pick situations and you can be aggressive attacking downhill, you just only put him, wearing him down even more. Right now, the Nuggets don't have a solid number two option that they can count on. Jamal Murray, he's getting 20 points, but it's not that devastating 20 that you're accustomed to getting from him. Like, you know,
you
those timely,
yeah,
those timely baskets, it's not really happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't feel it. And he hasn't had those timely baskets that you become accustomed to seeing him have in the fourth quarter of games, as we saw him have in the 2023 Western Conference Finals against the Lakers, even last year in round one against LA, and even a few times in that Minnesota series in the Western Conference semifinals. So they got to get him going or see if it's a way that they can, because otherwise it's going to be tough for them, especially when their bench is so thin. And speaking of benches, that Clippers bench, they leaving a lot left to be desired. Bogdan Bogdanovic, he's gotten off to a real slow start in this series. I know this hasn't been the best year in his career, but he closed off the season rather strong for the Clippers. I want to see if he can pick it back up going back home in the Intuit Dome, where you know those fans are going to be loud and ready to go for the first ever playoff game in that brand new shiny arena out in downtown Inglewood.
Yeah, and we still got a Norm Powell game to come. Usually we all know some of the cliches. You know, role players tend to play better at home.
Yeah, and you speak of Norm Powell, I mean, he hit the go-ahead shot late in that game and was struggling, but had enough confidence to take it late to help the Clippers win on the road and draw even in that best of seven series, which, in my opinion right now, is looking like the best damn series in all of the playoffs.
Oh, for sure. For sure. This one and I guess that Knicks Pistons series, even though there's some disgusting displays of basketball integrity out there.
Well, that's a wrap on the latest edition of the New 24. If you like what you've heard through the first 24 episodes, including this one, then please feel free to leave us a 5-star rating with comment, letting us know what you think about the podcast across the platforms you use to listen to your favorite shows. We cannot thank you enough for all of your continued support. You can also give us a follow on the official social media platform for the New 24 across Instagram and X at TNTF_. To make sure you don't miss out on any announcements regarding upcoming episodes, as well as all the latest currently trending around the NBA, don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feed at rss.com/podcast/TNTF. We got a lot more on the horizon as far as it pertains to the overall discussions and action that will come to define the 2025 postseason. Once again, from myself, Gabriel Wilkins, and my co-host, Torrence Stagger, we appreciate you tuning in yet again and hope that you all have a great week. And as always, peace.